Well, it's finally official. I know, because as we were sharing a meal together this evening, what we were listening to were Christmas carols. The Christmas season has formally begun. However, in all reality, and probably for all practical purposes, the season began weeks ago. It certainly goes back to well before Halloween. And in some cases, it may even have preceded Labor Day, depending on where you shop. But if you carefully read and precisely observe the text of your calendar, following the principles of hermeneutics, one of the courses this semester, if you thoroughly examine the surrounding context of that calendar page, you'll make an important discovery. You'll uncover a unique textual insight. It's Thanksgiving weekend. Now, having observed the November date carefully, having interpreted this significant calendar text accurately, you're now ready to apply it to yourself personally. So, what should this season mean to us practically? What is the point of Thanksgiving? And how does it fit into the Jewish calendar? Because there are some within the Jewish community, granted by no means the majority, who think that Thanksgiving is not necessarily a holiday for Jewish people. Well, as it turns out, there are a number of reasons for this season. If I might put it into the contextual terms for this weekend, we've got a cornucopia, a plethora, a panoply of things to be thankful for. And besides all of that, as hopefully you've thought back over them over these last couple of days, God instructs you to do just that. In other words, to be thankful in a comprehensive command that is found in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5:18. And that text says the following. It says, in everything give thanks. In other words, in all your circumstances, in all situations, in other words, wherever you find yourself, or as the alternate Pew Bible points out for us, it's the one that's stacked at the end of the rows usually, no matter what happens, we thank God. No matter what happens, come on, when the really lousy stuff comes our direction, whether that's health or whether that's work-related, and by work-related I mean whether or not you have work, or if you do have work, the people you have to work with, or whatever, in every situation, no exceptions. No exceptions? Well, that's precisely the point or the lesson of the various forms of Kaddish, of which we did Sephardi Kaddish tonight. There is a story that's associated with Kaddish. It's the story of Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir was a very important rabbi of the second century. And as I recall, wasn't it Bruria who was his wife, who was a very important rabbinic figure as well? But that's a whole other story that I'm not going to get into tonight. Well, anyhow, the story goes on. His two sons died on Shabbat. And when he returned home, his wife told him about the situation in the following fashion. His wife said, a friend gave me jewels for safekeeping. Now she wants them back. What should I do? Well, the rabbi responded, return the jewels, of course. And so she responded, the jewels are our sons. And his response was just as striking. The Lord has given, and the Lord has taken. Blessed be the name of the Lord. By the way, that's taken directly from Job. Kaddish, in fact, can be viewed as an amplification of this. It reminds us of God's sovereignty and mercy and graciousness, regardless of the circumstances. Now, this time of year, 4 years ago, there was a Pew study or survey, and by that, you know, I was going to say, has nothing to do with that which you are sitting in, but in some sense, it is related to pews, because they tend to be religious studies. Anyhow, it found in the survey at this time of year, 4 years ago, that 70% of the Jewish people, quote, feel a strong sense of gratitude every week. And to which I say, so be it with us. because it's an important part of our heritage. You see, there's always something you can be thankful for. By way of an example, you can be thankful that you're not part of the family whose grandfather died very peacefully in his sleep, not screaming like all the passengers in his car. More seriously, if you've read the scriptures, the biblical text, carefully, have you noticed how strongly the Bible implies that everything God created serves His ultimate purpose and plan? In a recent book by a very well-credentialed, he's an astronomer, but he's got a more specific focus than that. But anyhow, his name is Hugh Ross. He wrote in a book called The Improbable Planet, in which he makes a scientific case that all of creation, including countless details often never considered, that all of creation has been exquisitely designed and shaped so that many billions of humans can live on this life-sustaining planet, and additionally, as he points out at the end, be rescued and enter an eternal loving relationship with the God who created it. In the apologetics course next semester, we'll deal with this a little bit as well. So if you want to know more, come see us next semester. Anyhow, the book The Improbable Planet offers a comprehensive picture of the myriad of unlikely events that converge so that in one tiny time window, billions of humans could occupy a planet that's exquisitely designed for life. To quote part of the book and the author, the unlikely events by which our earthly home came together include the assembly of essential construction materials, the selection of an appropriate neighborhood, protection and preparation of the construction site, establishment of a stable foundation, development of heating, air conditioning, and ventilation systems, structural supports both below and above ground, and of course, the magnificently beautiful finishing touches. Countless aspects of our habitat that we take for granted, from the richness of soil for food production and our remarkably stable climate, perhaps not quite so stable as it used to be, but anyhow, when examined closely, reveal an intricate matrix of miracles. Even the existence of resources required to make global travel and communication possible defies all probability. In fact, in that book, he works out the probabilities for these various factors that are essential for life on this planet. The probabilities that all of those things could fall together at one place in the right time. And if I remember right, his calculations are 1 out of 10 to the 90th power. So stick 90 zeros after the 10, and then you've got the figure, the probability factor for this. But again, more next semester. Now, given that understanding, that's a reason to thank God. Moving to another endeavor, there's a story of the great violinist, Yitzhak Proman. Once, as he began to play at a recital, one of the strings on his violin suddenly broke. Now, he could have thrown his violin down in anger, but instead, he transposed the music and played beautifully on three strings. Now, at the end of the concert, the audience broke out into thunderous applause, and afterwards, someone asked him, "Why did you go ahead and play with a broken string?" He replied, "That's what a true artist does. You play with the instrument you are given." And so, in life, we play with the instrument we are given. And we play with enthusiasm and joy, or we should. Now, I know there are a lot of people who view the world as a gloomy place. Regarding them, Jewish commentator, Dennis Prager, and again, I will say, as I've said before, with this man, I have a lot to disagree with. But there are some very important things and points he makes, and this is one of those. He speaks of what's called the broken tile syndrome. This is how it works. There's a person lying in bed who's looking at the tile. Don't look at the tile. Some of those are not so good to look at. And, of course, because I said that, most of you looked at the tiles, right? A person is lying in bed looking at the tiles in his ceiling. Now, 99 of them are aligned perfectly, but there is one tile that's broken. However, this person keeps staring at the broken tile and so is unable to get it out of his or her mind and move on and enjoy the 99 others. Some people just see the negative. And we all meet a lot of negative people. Often they are people dealing with unmet expectations or with all kinds of frustrations or sadness that come from ill health or inadequate wealth or pick any one of a number of things. And often with all kinds of losses as well. And yet, how often does their negativity further contribute to their feeling of loss? As it turns out, there's a mitzvah, there's a guided behavior in Judaism that says we are to look for joy in everything we do. We're to look for joy in everything we do. That's why the rabbi wrote what he wrote in 1 Thessalonians 5, which I quoted, or which I worked through very briefly with you. He also said, in writing the letter to the synagogues in Philippi, he said, rejoice. And then he says, I'll say it again, rejoice. The point is that we should look for reasons to compliment and not to complain. Now, there's a name by which this mitzvah goes, and I love the name. It's Hakarat Hatov. Hakarat Hatov. Recognizing the good. Now, this is a way you'll never forget the term. Hakarat Hatov does not mean the good carrot. Thank you for those of you who got that. As many thousands of years ago, King Solomon pointed out, and not in the text you'll probably expect me to quote Proverbs, but in the book Ecclesiastes, he pointed out that we should find joy in living, to see the best in the world. There were two little boys in a hospital lying on beds next to each other just outside the operating room. The first kid leaned over and asked, what are you in here for? The second kid said, I'm in here to get my tonsils out and I'm a little nervous. To this, the first kid responded, oh, you've got nothing to worry about. I had that done when I was 4. They put you to sleep, and when you wake up, they give you lots of Jell-O and ice cream. It's a breeze. Second kid then asked, what are you here for? First kid said, a circumcision. Now, on hearing this, the second king blurted, whoa, good luck, buddy. I had that done when I was 8 days old, and I couldn't walk for a whole year. Well, that's one way of seeing the best, recognizing the good. In other words, accomplishing the mitzvah of Hakarat HaTov. The classic story of Rabbi Akiva is another example, and some of you may be familiar with this story. It's a story well worth repeating, because it's a story that we often have to remind ourselves of. Rabbi Akiva, again, second century rabbi, was one of the greatest of our scholars. He lived shortly after the destruction of the Second Temple. And at one point, we are told he had some 24,000 pupils. Now, I was about to say it would be great to have 24,000 pupils in our yeshiva, but then I gave it a second thought and said, no, that's far too many students. But anyhow, he had 24,000 pupils. Once in the middle of a long journey, the story unfolds, and just before nightfall, he entered a large village to spend the night. But every house in the village rejected him. Rabbi Akiva, instead of getting angry, cheerfully said, Gamzu letovah. Gamzu letovah, meaning this too is for the good. And he exited the town. Soon he found a small clearing a good distance away, and so he settled down under a tree to sleep, thanking God that he still had his rooster, his candle, and his donkey. The rooster was to awaken him before dawn. The candle was there to provide him with the light necessary to learn Torah. And the donkey would take him then to his next destination. Well, suddenly a wind swept through his little encampment and extinguished the small candle, leaving him in almost complete darkness. He could barely see anything at all in the dim moonlight. His response, Gamzu letovah, this too is for the good. And he continued his preparations in the quiet night. Suddenly the silence was broken by an insane cackling and wild flapping. Rabbi Akiva turned just in time to see a weasel dragging away the quivering body of his rooster. "This, too, is for the good," he said calmly. He again lay back down and closed his eyes. It seemed like only moments later the air shook with an awesome roar and the frantic braying of his donkey. He sat up just in time to see a lion crouched on the thrashing carcass of his donkey. Now, instead of being filled with fear and gloom, Rabbi Akiva confidently repeated, "Gamzu, Latova, this too is for the good." So he closed his eyes and again went to sleep. The next morning he woke to the smell of smoke. He sat up and looked out in the direction of the town. It was totally in flames. That night, a large band of robbers had raided the place, killed most of the men, took away everyone else as slaves, and burned the entire city to the ground. "Aha," the rabbi said to himself. "If I had been in town, or if the candle had been lit, or the rooster had crowed, or the donkey had brayed, I would have been discovered, and certainly would not be here now. Gamzu, Latova." That's an important part of the reality of Hakarat HaTov. But by the way, we do need to remind ourselves we don't always get to see the end result of the story, as Rabbi Akiva did. But let me suggest something about Hakarat HaTov, recognizing the good. It's more than just gratitude. It means recognizing the divine image in every person. We call that Tselem Elohim. So bestowing kindness on another person then becomes a godly act. The more distant the relationship between the giver and the receiver, the rabbis of old tell us, the more godly the act is. Furthermore, based on that understanding, the kindness that God shows us is therefore the ultimate unselfish kindness. So the one who imitates it is the most godlike. Integrating Hakarat HaTov, not just regarding our circumstances, but also regarding people, fosters harmony and feeds community. It lays the foundation for compassion and for connection, the kind of compassion and connection and community so many people are looking for in troubled and in less troubled times. And it's an important part of saying thank you to God. By the way, one of our favorite synagogues, other than this one, New York Central Synagogue. We tend to hop into one of their services, since one service for us isn't enough. Friday night when we go home, sometimes we sit through a second one. But anyhow, New York Central Synagogue offers a model of a Thanksgiving Seder on its website. How wonderful and how perfect. Some historians have even suggested that the Puritan settlers modeled Thanksgiving on our Sukkot festival, which is also celebrated around the time of the fall harvest. And it might not be entirely accidental then that the Hebrew word for Thanksgiving, hodiah, is similar, as I found out just this week, thanks to a reminder from the Jewish press and one of the rabbis writing in it. The Hebrew word for Thanksgiving, hodiah, is similar to the Hebrew word for turkey, hodu. In fact, It reminds us of one of our songs, Hodu Lad Hashem Ki Tov. Hodu Lad Hashem Ki Tov, which says, "Give thanks to the Lord." As we were reminded near the outset of the service, 1 Chronicles 16, "Give thanks to the Lord, to Adonai. Call on his name. Make his deeds known among the peoples. Sing to him. Sing praises to him. Talk about all his wonders. Glory in his holy name. Always seek his presence. Remember the wonders he has done. Give thanks to Adonai, for he is good, for his graciousness continues forever. Blessed be Adonai, the God of Israel, from eternity past to eternity future. Hodu Lad Hashem Ki Tov." That's our opportunity. Take advantage of it now, briefly, and for the rest of this weekend. and for the rest of the year. And by the rest of the year, I don't mean until January. We just started the new year, remember? So for the rest of the year. And begin that response in quiet, please.